Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
And thanks for joining me for another Blunt Business here on CannabisRio.com. And really happy to go have on a guest that we never got a chance to go and feature on Blunt Business previously, but all I know is that the chance to get an opportunity to go and talk to this next guest, it goes back almost really 5 years. I got a chance to go and connect with her because we were talking about Section 280E, and there was a couple of spots we had open during our USCC Expo when we had that conference up and going until COVID decided to go and take a damper on everything, right? But at the time, she was an associate attorney, and without going into the full detail, just ramped herself back up almost 5 years later, and all the work that she's done and the climb in such a, I feel like it's a very short amount of time to make her way into the cannabis space right now from the legal sense has been incredible. So she's an attorney and consultant working primarily in the cannabis industry on a multi-state level. Most of her work involves competitive licensing and regulatory compliance. She has worked on competitive applications for cannabis businesses in Alabama, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Missouri, New York, New Jersey, Texas, and West Virginia. Sure, there might be a state we're missing at some point, but her overall success rate is approximately 85% at attaining cannabis business licenses. And I'm so glad to go and welcome back on. We had her back in 2019 on the USCC Expo Experience. She was also on our Freedom to Buy program, speaking extensively on the areas of Section 280E, but we're happy to go and bring back the founding partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group, Paula Savchenko Esquire. Paula, it's so good to have you back on. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back on, and good to be speaking with you again.
Before we even get started, and I don't make this kind of a thing that can put a whole lot of praise for guests. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of great people we have on the program, and I never go into whole backgrounds of things, but like, I must say, I'm not trying to blow smoke. I'm telling you, it's very impressive what you've been able to do in this cannabis space and work your way up, because it was a matter of that. I felt like it was really, you were never going to have to be set to a place where you wanted to go ahead and just be in a law firm and just say, okay, there's the normal trek of growth and, you know, moving up in a firm to become a partner. Well, then you went ahead and moved yourself up to the partner and such a, I mean, because you're still relatively, you're very young. And it's like, I don't know how, I mean, in such amount of time, it's like, to me, I would almost feel like you've come right out of college. And it's like, you immediately just went and just, you moved yourself up so quickly. But that's just a testament to your expertise, your business acumen, and just your understanding of the space and being able to go and do so much now where you have encompassed so much ability to help out so many different cannabis companies in a plethora of states right now and getting them the licensing and getting through this licensing and compliance process. So 5 years removed, talk to me about this direction. I mean, do you feel like you've surpassed the expectations that you had set and laid out for yourself? Was there a 5-year plan in place to get here?
So originally when I got involved in the cannabis industry, you know, I just wanted to get involved. So that was kind of the shorter term plan. And then once I got involved, then I saw a clearer path forward to start my own consulting company and law firm. and service clients almost exclusively in the cannabis and psychedelics industries. And it just made sense, you know, because the firm that I was at was doing other work. I also wanted to be able to take equity in my clients, and that just wasn't feasible at the other firm that I was at. And, you know, sometimes I think it just takes being in the right place at the right time. If I decided to go into a different industry, I think it would have been a lot more difficult to grow to the extent that I have in the past 5 years. But because the cannabis industry, you know, like the running joke in this industry is 1 year equals like 7 years, like how dog years are. Because of that, and because it's such a new industry, I was able to take advantage of that. And I'm really thankful for that. And being able to grow with this industry has been really interesting. And I've learned a lot through that process.
And some of the legal folks we've had here on the program, there's been a lot of young professionals that just found you just can't come with a conventional approach like you would in other, you know, other legal fields in other businesses. In cannabis, it's a matter of having a different mindset and just realizing you got to have more progressive goals. You have to have a better understanding. And just for some, I think they just think that it's probably a headache of being in such a highly regulated industry. And then the paperwork and what has to go into understanding the licensing, understanding the rules and regulations of every cannabis board in other states, because that's a lot of states you're covering. And to have that understanding, that it boggles my mind that you're able to go ahead and manage all that. Plus now, you know, being a manager yourself and handling your team and all those fellow litigants trying to go and work on all these different states and all these different companies that you have. I don't know how many you're working on a regular basis, but it's a lot of work. And, you know, I think it has to be somebody that is ambitious like yourself to handle this. It just can't just be any legal practice that can come into the field.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with that. I mean, it's definitely a lot of work to be able to keep up to date with the regulations in multiple states. I will say it's a situation where once you kind of figure out the formula, it gets a little easier. But because it is a new state, you know, second time around in the same state, we do have to spend a lot of time staying up to date. And my team's really great about staying on top of new regulations that come out, keeping myself and our clients up to date on that, and then helping our clients to capitalize on those opportunities because we are on top of that. And some of that comes with, you know, time, like you said, it's just time. And the other part of that is having experience in the industry, being able to anticipate what's going to be coming up just based on what other states have done, and then having the right relationships in multiple states and maintaining those relationships so that you are hearing what's going on in those states firsthand. So I would say those kind of three areas is what has helped us to be successful in multiple states.
Now, one of the things I look at, I want to imagine that not only is it a matter of practice of how you're able to go ahead and obtain licenses in various states with various programs, but also the size and scale of the companies that you're working with. I wanted to see if you can give me any idea of what the ratio looks like of how many companies you're working with that are MSOs, that are more craft businesses, more that are social equity licensees. Can you give me an idea with Canaccord Group of what the level and the ratio of clients that you have and what size businesses they are?
Yeah, definitely. I would say in the past, we did work, most of our business was MSOs and the larger MSOs. As the industry has gone on and these MSOs have gotten, I would say, leaner, they have leaner with outsourcing. They have built their in-house teams to handle their multi-state application processes. And so we actually had conversations with a couple of clients that wanted us to go in-house with them. And that just wasn't in my business plan. And so now we can still consult with them, and sometimes we'll do like a final review. But it's switched from us running that whole application process for them to just to being, you know, overseeing consultants or a final review. So I'd say at this point, it's now switched to the larger publicly traded MSOs being on the smaller side of our business to having medium-sized businesses for the most part. I would say 75% of our business is somewhere between single state operators to smaller multi-state operators. So under four states. And they are looking to expand at this point. Another trend that we've seen is that the MSOs in the industry have historically been expanding into new states and were really heavy on that process in the past are now looking to just kind of consolidate or make sure that they can handle what they have as opposed to, or even selling off assets as opposed to being focused on expansion. Because we all know where the industry is at right now. You know, it's very difficult to raise capital. A lot of these MSOs that were able to, you know, were not the most lean in the past are now kind of having to reposition themselves and reevaluate all of that. So we're in a little bit of like a pivotal place in the industry. And I think that will even out over the next year or two. And then the medium sized operators that have always been lean and always been more strategic, or sorry, not more strategic, always been had to be very strategic and careful about their expansion. They are now in a position, more of a position to be able to expand. So we're seeing that side. And then with the social equity side, because states are now carving out licenses for social equity over the past 2 years, I would say, we've seen a huge influx in business from those businesses as well. So most of our businesses is in the medium size and to social equity applicants at this point.
Want to unpack a few things that you may point off of there. First of all, it's got to be a badge of trust for the fact that you have large MSOs that were in the space that said, hey, you know what, you're doing such a great job. I think we want to just bring you in full time and just come in-house for us and just, you know, take over for us. You're doing the job for us. And I can understand where they're coming from with that. But the other thing too is that also can understand, you know, for me, I'm not one of those that wanted to be in the corporate space for too long because you're just coming in, you know, what's your freedom and what's your access to go and continue to work with other companies. And then what they might ask you to do, it's like, well, I'd either have the freedom to go and say, well, I'll still be an independent contractor. I'd prefer to do that. But for companies to go and say they wanted to have you that way, that was great. The other thing, too, is that the approach of working with MSOs that are medium size that are on the move for expansion and growth, but I also can imagine it's a bit of a tightrope to say, okay, well, I want to continue expanding, but again, every time we grow, it's another cultivation we have to set up. It's another replication of the same infrastructure as before without waiting for legalization so that we can have interstate commerce come into play. I imagine that right there would be, so it's a controlled growth. And again, like you said, it's not necessarily, you know, and always been a strategy, but there is a very highly, you know, thought out plan of strategy and execution on being able to go ahead and grow research development and where can you go into new markets eventually and what new markets open up. The other thing too is, again, it's continued legalization. For me, I know that we're still waiting to see, you know, if there'll be a supermajority in Congress. Again, I'm not like these other people with happy talk. Other podcasters, you know, God bless you. I'm not going to be one of those people that's going to keep saying, oh, you know, legalization is just right around the corner. No, it's not. Stop thinking that way. Stop thinking the safe bank acts could just be, oh, they're trying to sneak it in. They're going to do something. No, we're not. Unless there's a supermajority in Congress, whether Republican or Democrat, no matter what, it has to be one side or the other. They'll eventually get to cannabis. It's already a bill that's already been written over and over plenty of times. And when eventually one side or the other is a supermajority, two-thirds House, two-thirds Senate, I think cannabis finally gets passed. Legalization will finally happen. It doesn't matter which side of the aisle. I really believe that. But until then, you know, this process, you can license whoever you want, but it's also like every time you have a license comes in, you know, it's the part of for the private companies that are out there or publicly traded, large or medium-sized MSOs that have to come in. That's the direction you have to go. Now, for social equity licensees, is a different scenario. So early part of the year, I don't know why it is in January, February, but I guess we've had a lot of social equity licensees. Great stories, by the way, we've gotten so far from Illinois, New York, and what have you. So we've talked about the various licensing systems for social equity licensees, CURDs, conditional adult use dispensaries in New York, a lottery system in Illinois. And we know that there's some possibilities we looked at where, and this was been talked about by the guests, but I want to just ask you about this. Have you seen any possibilities where MSOs or other companies could exploit some of the loopholes in the case? They're a social equity licensee, and however they get their license, the funding is not there for them to be able to sustain and work through the inspection process, go through the process of saying they have to open up a temporary facility, then to go ahead and get an inspection on the permanent building to finally go and open up, and all the time they need to be able to go in and stay sustainable without making any money in the process. It's just build, 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 and inspect, inspect, inspect. That if the social equity licensees are not able to go ahead and go forward and execute the license and get a business open, that they could sell it off to an MSO or someone else, you know, could you see where there's loopholes where the social equity licensee could sell the license if they can successfully run the process to open a business? So the social equity licensee, they go through the process, they get the license, and they can just sell it. And that next company doesn't have to be under that social equity parameter.
The social equity states figuring out how to actually benefit the social equity individuals is an ongoing battle. And of course, you know, they have the best intentions when they're passing these regulations, but it's also difficult to think through every scenario. And then, like you mentioned, the social equity applicants aren't always the ones that have the funding. And it's difficult for them to find the funding to fully build out these facilities. So then there's situations where they're stuck and they need someone to come in and help them operate because they don't have the cannabis experience a lot of the time, and to help them with funding. And so sometimes a multi-state operator or a single state operator, someone that has experience in the cannabis industry coming in and helping with those operations or building out those licenses is a great scenario for these social equity applicants, because they either can still be involved if that's the agreement that they make, or they can sell the license and then have a financial benefit still. Now, the regulators are trying to, like you said, close the loophole on allowing that from happening. But, in some states, I think they're very much aware that this is going to happen. Like, for example, in New Jersey, they had a social equity program, and those regulations basically claim that the ownership has to stay the same for 2 years after the license is issued. And then after those 2 years, the ownership can change, and it more likely than not will get approved. So, and then there's other states that are requiring the social equity applicant to hold or whoever purchases it to also be qualifying as a social equity applicant to hold the equity, or at least majority equity. And I think that I just think it's not reasonable for these regulators to require that. But they're in a hard place because they need to also benefit, or they would like to benefit, the social equity applicants. I mean, Virginia is working through their recreational bill right now on how they're going to issue additional licenses for their recreational program. And the most recent, the last draft had each current license holder having to give money to a fund that would then go to the social equity applicants. And, you know, that is a good way to help these social equity applicants get off the ground, but then you're still dealing with them not having the experience. And so I think maybe further setting up some type of incubation program where these operators help, or some type of, you know, having experts come in and teach them would be also beneficial, because it's kind of like you can teach a fish, or you can teach a man how to fish, right? Or you can give them fish. I mean, it's
yeah, you can catch a fish for them, or give them a pole and let them know how to catch a fish.
Exactly.
Some of the applicants we had on, you know, they've given some great advice when it came down to it. And we've had those that, you know, there was one group in Illinois that, you know, they didn't have to go to the program. Like, they were more enough, you know, avid and very erudite business owners in their own respect, but the social equity licensing, you know, they fit the quota. You know, they checked all the boxes. Like, okay, we'll take the licensing that route, but they didn't worry about the grants or the funding that came out of it. One of the stories I brought up with a couple of other attorneys here on the program we've had on this year, there was a great story that came from NPR, the indicator from Planet Money, and they broke down what was going on with the New York's Cannabis Social Equity Investment Fund, because, and this is one of those things, and I don't know how this is for every other state, but it's one of those things where, you know, it's not free money. Second, the kind of money that's being put in, it's what even what the grant's going to give you is not even going to come close to what it needs for operating costs or to get you all the way to the finish line to, you know, snapping the ribbon to do the grand opening for your business. Not even enough. You have to have other resources. You got to be able to find the right people. And enough of us, these licensees we've had on that have been successful to work either in New York, in Illinois, or even in D.C. in that matter, for some of the people we've had there. They have to go ahead and know the right people, get the right money in place, and the right partners in place to be able to make this all possible. So, you know, for the do-good that the states will have to have social equity licensing, there's not enough, like you said, an incubation process or anything else to give the resources, the wherewithal, so they can get these businesses off the ground. Because it's fine to give them the license, but okay, if they have to sell it off, that doesn't do any good for anyone. And then on top of that, we want the business to actually succeed. So it's not just giving them the chance to get the license. They got to be able to successfully get the license and open. Now, in the story from NPR, they made a point about one of these licensees that, you know, there's a $200 million social equity fund, and I think there was more money being added to it by the governor, Kathy Hochul. But on top of that, they don't understand, for some of those that come in, it's a loan from Chicago Atlantic, a private investment firm, and the interest that they have to go and pay on it is 13 to 14%. So, like, okay, you're getting a public-private partnership. I don't know if this other states apply the same way, but the matter is that it's like you made a point, Paul. I just don't think there's enough information out there provided by the states, nor do the licensees have enough to be informed or have enough of the right infrastructure for them to succeed. What do you say about that? Because obviously you have some types that either know, you've heard about or are aware of, or that you might be working with within your firm, that these are the kind of ongoing problems you're going with, they're dealing with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just going back to New Jersey, there are a lot of individuals that have been issued licenses, social equity licenses, and they now are sitting in limbo and don't have the financial resources to build the license out or the experience. And they don't know how to get that, you know, either of those pieces. And so we've had situations where, you know, we've spoken to either investors or operators that are interested in entering New Jersey and made partnerships for these social equity applicants to work with those investors and or operators. And then they can come in, manage the process for them, buy into it, you know, for equity, or set up a management services agreement and go that route. But they need someone, you know, like us, or to make someone that can make an introduction for them and then set up the agreement for them properly, so everybody's benefiting, everybody's protected, and then move in that direction. And I mean, a lot of them are stuck because they are either scared to give up the, you know, too much equity and get taken advantage of, or they just don't have the experience to do that. So So, you know, they're in a tough spot, that route, but there are ways, you know, there are, they have options. They just need to be proactive and meet the right people to be able to set that up. And then some, as far as Chicago Atlantic, being a lender for New York, you know, that's great that they're willing to provide those loans. But yeah, I agree. 13% is normal for the cannabis industry, but it's higher than several other industries. And then again, going back to a lot of these social equity applicants, unfortunately, not being sophisticated and potentially not fully understanding what type of agreement or loan they're entering into.
Right.
A loan agreement they're entering into is somewhat problematic because, you know, they need someone. It kind of highlights the need for someone like us, I guess, but also other experts that have the operational side, you know, kind of rounding out that business. And it goes back to what we were talking about before. You can give them the money, but they still have to know what to do with it.
Right.
And that's why I think that going the route of these incubation programs is really a step in the right direction for these states. Although it you know, it may take more time and resources, it would set them up to go in the right direction at least.
And I'm not here to go ahead and put any, you know, place any negativity on Chicago Atlantic. Listen, they're a business. They're going to try to make their money. This is, they're setting it up just like they would. They're not, you know, they're not hiding anything from it. It's pretty transparent. It's the way it's going to be. So I don't blame, you know, the state to do a public-private partnership. I don't blame what this being done with this. But again, it's like, you know, if you're going to, you think, you know, the intent that what all these states are doing with these programs is good, sure. But you got to also look at the follow through. And as like you said, you know, for those that are going to get this money and they want to be able to go and be, you know, smart about using that money, you know, proprietary to get the business up and open. I mean, it's pretty obvious that, you know, would you say that while there are organizations that try to provide services and try to provide, you know, a connection or a network of people that social equity licenses can go ahead and speak to, would you say it would still be something that, like, if somebody is working with your team at Canaccord, do you have those resources that you can possibly refer them to help them in the process while they're getting their license up and situated?
Yeah, definitely. That's exactly what we get involved in. Okay. Yeah, we work with our social equity applicants. We help them to build a team around them that can work through those steps with them. And then we've had social equity applicants reach out to us that we didn't work with that we helped in that way as well.
Yeah. Wonderful. There's so much more we're going to get into right now, but we're going to go ahead and step away and we'll segue out of social equity. We're going to get into the area of other businesses when it comes to what is going on right now and changes that are going on within the state of Florida. We're going to talk about that in terms of some of the MSOs looking to go ahead and make changes over there in terms of who's going to be owning them and who's going to be taking them over. We're going to also talk about the lawsuit that also came in place that was trying to halt the cannabis licensing process in the state of New York, and among other things. And also want to go talk about some things when it came into, you know, being profiled. You were profiled by Authority Magazine and some of the areas of expanding into other areas outside of cannabis. We're going to talk about all that here. I'm here with the founding partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group, Paula Savchenko, Esquire, and back with more questions after this.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with the founding partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group, Paula Savchenko. By the way, website, if you want to take a look at more when we talk about Canaccord Group and what they provide in terms of cannabis and psychedelic business licensing, their website is Canaccord Group. So it's CanaccordGRP.com. One more time, CanaccordGRP.com. The psychedelic licensing, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the next segment. But I want to go on to a couple of current stories that are going right now in the news. Specifically, there was an op-ed here in Florida where you and I are based in South Florida. And Florida voters are coming up in November. And if I'm correct, the Supreme Court has allowed the petition to go through. Do we know at this point if the voters are going to be able to go ahead and vote on the ballot for legalization this fall?
So we are still waiting on the Supreme Court to make a decision on that. And I believe they have to make a decision by sometime in April.
Okay. So we're waiting on that. But I know that the framework, the language was the issue the last time around. The Florida Supreme Court had this in for the 2020 election, which is why the ballot initiative never got forward like it did for medical back in 2016. But where we're at now, it looks like all, you know, if the Supreme Court goes through, it's pretty much, I'm not going to say it's a rubber stamp, but I would believe it's pretty obvious that Florida voters want to go ahead and vote cannabis to be adult use or recreational coming up to this cycle. So 2025 would be a very good year for Florida to start rolling out, much like other states, you know, sooner than later. But several medical marijuana treatment centers, which is what our licensees are here in the state and especially the MSOs, they're being put for sale in Florida as soon as this spring. I know we talked to the folks at Planet 13 that took over VitaCann. We know there's other companies that are, you know, kind of changing things up from the Columbia Care to be called the Cannabis. And then there's other, I mean, yeah, I'm in Florida and I see all these different buildings and we see names changing for different companies all across the board. There's obviously been a lot of shuffling of, you know, mid-size companies to larger size, and they're kind of positioning themselves to wherever they're going to be in the market. They are definitely getting themselves set for legalization, and that's where I'm looking at right now. So the Florida Office of Medical Marijuana Use is expected to announce the winners of 22 medical marijuana treatment centers licenses for the first week of April, nearly doubling the number of existing permits. So with all these new MMTCs coming into play, all these licenses coming into play, do you feel like this is being done because it's a proactive move for them to realize, okay, legalization is about to be here. The voters are going to give us the access and we're just getting ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, there's multiple facets that are playing into positive movement towards a recreational event in Florida. One of them is definitely the current license holders and the applicants that for this new application round that should be released later this, the results of should be released later this year. They're pushing for this because it's only going to expand their business. I mean, most MSOs are not profitable in medical markets. And so they're really just sitting waiting for the recreational market to come alive in those states. So yeah, there's definitely a push from that side. I also think that because there's so much movement on the federal level, it's opening the door to make the conversation easier on a state level to legalize recreational marijuana as well.
And just to preface, the op-ed was from MJ Biz Daily about that story in Florida. I want to take now from Cannabis Business Times. Now, there's a federal judge back early in February 2nd, that a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit that sought to halt New York's cannabis licensing process. I know we've heard a couple of stories like this where, you know, various lawsuits have been brought into place, whether they're, you know, whatever integrity those lawsuits come in, that they're being brought in to try to go ahead and stop, you know, further growth of the adult use or recreational side of cannabis in New York. Albany Judge Ann Nardacci rejected litigation brought in December by two LA-based companies seeking a restraining order and preliminary injunction to stop regulators from issuing licenses while the lawsuit made its way through court, according to the Associated Press. And California-based applicants argued also that New York's adult use cannabis licensing program unconstitutionally discriminates against out-of-state residents. And at the center of the plaintiff's argument was the Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, barring states from adopting protectionist policies to restrict interstate commerce when there are no rules in place from Congress. And the plaintiffs claimed the Dormant Commerce Clause should allow them to participate in New York's cannabis market, but the judge said that the main purpose of the clause does not apply to the federally illegal cannabis industry, according to AP. So these lawsuits coming into play, trying to pause out the rollout of the cannabis program, I wanted to get your thoughts about the usage of this Dormant Commerce Clause. I know I've talked to other attorneys about this as well, but, you know, the attempts to try to go ahead and stunt or slow down the growth, and can any of these lawsuits come into play where you feel like they might, you know, they might be effective at slowing down or stopping a cannabis program from proceeding?
Yeah, definitely. So states having requirements, residency requirements, or in-state favoritism, we have seen that in several states, and it's been interesting to watch because I would say about 75% of those laws have been struck down for being a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. And then those states have had to come forward with new laws or regulations implementing that program. And then there's been, you know, a very small percentage of states that have not struck that down. And this is the first time that we've seen, or at least that I'm aware of, that we've seen a judge say, well, Dormant Commerce Clause doesn't apply because this is federally illegal. And so that's definitely an interesting take on it and ruling. I'm not 100% sure if the Dormant Commerce Clause can apply when it's federally illegal or not. Obviously, this judge, who I'm sure has a lot of knowledge on this topic, does. But it just doesn't make sense to me because other judges have struck the Dormant Commerce Clause down for that reason. Now, the times when we've seen it upheld, these types of laws upheld in other situations and other states, is when it's not necessarily a requirement that the majority ownership be a resident or some type of favoritism towards a local. It's when it's a bonus point or something of that matter. And a lot of these cases, most of these cases are stemming off of actually a liquor case out of Tennessee that was heard before the Supreme Court. And there was a Tennessee law that required to hold a liquor license, you had to be a resident of Tennessee for, I believe, 2 years. And so a company that wanted to enter that had recently, you know, moved there to Tennessee and wanted to enter into the market, right, they challenged this and it was struck down. So that's what these cannabis companies are relying on. So I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't have a 100% answer on that.
No. But it's loopholes. They're just trying to find ways to roadblock or just disrupt the industry in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's all it is to me, because it's like, you know, for those who want to come in, yeah, I understand there might be some, look, and New York just had their rollout only just sort of started this year and going into last year. So there's only so many licensees coming into the space, and it's not like you're letting a free reign come in. There's a filter going through, but it's like, for those, I guess they feel like if they can't get themselves into the industry, into the space right now, because they want to be in New York so badly, well, then let's go and throw lawsuits in here to see if we can try to open the door to allow our company to get in. So, like, if they have the money for it, they're going to try to go, you know, let's litigate. Let's see if we can try to get something to happen. But, you know, it's one of those things where if it's not this lawsuit, there'll be other lawsuits that come into place for some other reason to try to stop the industry. It's just the way everybody wants to do it. If for obviously there's some people that just have the intent to want to shut the industry down in some way, shape, or form, they can get it break from piece by piece, and they'll go and do that too. That's their initiative. That there's their modus operandi. We're going to go back to another break. When we come on back, we're going to go ahead and talk about some areas when it comes to where Canaccord Group is right now identifying and applying for grants on federal and state levels for groups for cannabis and psychedelics. We're going to bring that up a little bit. After a short break, I'm here again with Paul Savchenko, founding partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group. Here on Blunt Business, back with final questions for this.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
We're back once again with more Blunt Business here. Final questions here with Paul Savchenko, Esquire, partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group. Again, website, I'll make sure to go and let you know to learn about their full-service marijuana and psychedelics business licensing. Website is canaccordgroup.com, CanaccorGrp.com. You can schedule a meeting, you can go through and look all areas of states, overviews, services, and a lot of information there. Along with that, Paula, I really love that you have made so much time for us, you know, especially with the Freedom of the Body. We talked about Section 280 and the rescheduling possibilities of HHS, with all these ongoing stories that are going on. But I'm glad we had to get a chance to talk about the licensing issue here, in particular for different states, from the social equity level to the MSO level to the roadblocks that have been put into place. But now finally, Authority Magazine spoke with you pretty extensively, and they talked about how Canaccord Group and your team are identifying and applying for grants, quote, on the federal and state levels for groups in the cannabis and psychedelic industries. And this will help the industries in two main ways. First, these grants are usually research-focused, so the focal point of the work will help to bring new ideas to market, such as methods to expand patient education and access. Secondly, as it is typically very expensive to get involved in these industries, my hope is that this will help those that are passionate about adding value to the industries to be able to get involved, end quote. So we're hearing a little bit in the psychedelic side in our programming there about, you know, research grants. I know there was one group that actually does talk about in Kentucky, Ibogaine, finally getting a research grant, and one of our hosts of a new program we're bringing on board, Psychedelic Breakthrough Addiction Therapies, Dr. Deborah Mash. Her firm is actually going to be necessarily involved in the research grant for that part for Ibogaine, which is wonderful to hear. And we'll obviously hear about that and other programs here on the psychedelic side. But I just wanted to get your thoughts about the research grants and what you're doing right now in the psychedelics end of the business, and also for cannabis in terms of research.
Yeah, definitely. So the NIH and other federal agencies publish grants that are available to apply for on a regular basis. And a lot of groups in the cannabis and psychedelic industries don't know about these because most of these grants aren't targeted specifically for these industries. It would instead be a broader request for a proposal that would say, you know, looking for new drugs or new modalities that would be helpful for veterans with PTSD, something along those lines. And then you can submit your proposal and say, well, we would like to do research on, and here's our plan, including this type of cannabis or hemp, or this type of psychedelic that would assist, or, you know, even this type of this cannabis combined with this modality. Here's our plan for how it would be administered. Here's the experience of our team and why we are the best people to be researching this. And then you submit it, and they usually have money allocated to give the grant to multiple groups as opposed to just one. And then a lot of the times when you're partnered with a university on that research, then you'll be able to, you're more likely to get selected for that. So because the universities have more bandwidth to be able to manage that process, have additional tools, can work with the testing site, because these universities go through this process on a regular basis. And so we try to advise our clients to partner with universities. We have some relationships there. And then we help with managing that process and, well, identifying and then managing that process, putting together the grant and submitting it for them. There's also grants now coming out on the state level for cannabis and psychedelics as well. And it's been interesting because just, you know, this session that most states are in right now, several states have passed legislation or are very close to passing legislation that would set up a task force and then set up funding for groups in the industry to move forward with research. And I mean, Kentucky, I think, was working to allocate $42 million towards grant research. And so in psychedelics specifically. So that's what we're working with groups on. And we're really excited about that because you know, one of the biggest barriers as we keeps coming up somehow in this conversation is that financing is really difficult for both of these industries. And so this will help to break down that barrier some and bring in more research for the industries.
Right. So you make a point. That was Attorney General Daniel Cameron of Kentucky that announced back in May that it would be $42 million will be allocated from their portion of the opioid settlement funds and use it for psychedelic research. Also, you know, even from a national level, you know, President Biden signing a defense spending bill, and what they included was $10 million for psychedelics research so that they could establish a system to allow active duty service members with PTSD or traumatic brain injuries to participate in clinical trials to study psilocybin, MDMA, ibogaine, and 5-MeO-DMT as treatments for the condition. So, I mean, there's money being put out there, and it's for, I mean, we're hearing so much about the programming here about psychedelics and the possibilities of it. So it's great to see this kind of work being come in, and it's great that kind of money is being brought in to do research here in the States. Because we see so much right now, even from, you know, scholarly levels where you see Johns Hopkins or Stanford and all, we're obviously seeing that people are really getting much into that. And it's great to go and see this being put in the place. So to be able to again also be involved in that way, it's wonderful to go and see that you're doing that kind of work. So how much more needs to happen? I mean, when you think about the level of research that's being done so far, what is it that Canaccord is looking to go and do in terms of to help to identify and apply for those grants? I mean, what's the barrier right now on it? Are there a lot of possibilities?
So there's a lot of possibilities. It obviously would be helpful if there were more federal grants that were actually targeted for this in these industries specifically, because, you know, what we're seeing is we're submitting these grants for psychedelics and cannabis or cannabis, and that's not really what NIH is looking for. And so we're seeing that sometimes it's difficult to actually get the grant funding because although you could say, you know, it should be fair and all that, there is still some looking down on the industries and some issues with, I think really it comes down to education, because people are still, there's a, you know, misconception with the industries and people are still scared of it. And so it's, I think it's really important what we're all doing, you know, like people like you getting the word out there, education and continuing to move forward with that so that people can understand that this is a legitimate industry and this really can help people and does help people. So I would say that's really the biggest area where I'm seeing that we can continue to grow and open up additional opportunities for the industry.
Wonder what you're doing. I mean, this is the extra part. I love this. Really feels like very philanthropic to this point, because not only, I mean, do I feel like you're helping a lot of companies, you know, at various levels when it comes to the social equity side or for medium-sized businesses to go and grow themselves out. And then on this end right here for the research grants, I mean, it's a real conscious awareness of saying, well, we're not just here, you know, just help people. Like, there's a lot more people that need help, not just for those that, for the legal end, but for those that, from the medical side, that we just need more people to help out and to get more access to all these wonderful treatments when it comes to cannabis and psychedelics. I love what you're doing. And it's amazing what you've been able to do so far. Again, in just only a couple of years, we've gotten to know you here on the network. And, you know, always at the door is always open to have you on back. And we'd love to continue to have this conversation. Paul, really, thanks so much for being on with us. Before we go and wrap up, we'll get on the website is Canaccord Group, CANNACOREGRP.com. For those that are looking to go ahead and work with your team, Take about 60 seconds just to go and help them know what they should be doing and how they can best reach out to you and, you know, what you can be able to go and provide to them.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having us on. And if you would like to get in contact with us, you can go to our website. There's a contact form there, www.canaccorpgroup.com. Or you can email us at our info email, info@canaccorpgroup.com. It's CANNACOREGRP.com. And we'll respond back to you to set up a time for a call. And if you are interested in getting in the psychedelics or cannabis industry, already involved and looking to expand, we'd be happy to talk to you, put together a plan if you're not sure exactly where you'd like to go, and then work with you to implement that plan.
Wonderful. Again, we've been here with Paul Sochenko, Esquire, founding partner of Canaccord Group and PS Law Group. Paul, thank you again for being on with us. And again, we'll definitely keep the door open to have you on back.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on. It was nice talking.
My pleasure, as always. And again, listeners, thank you again for checking out this episode with Blunt Business. And again, so much more to go and talk about this one in the space when it comes to social equity licensing, for licensing in general, and just the ongoing growth of the cannabis industry. You know, this is your one-stop place for all that information and more. And come back again for another episode next time.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10/1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help, you save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.